One of the most impressive tasting experiences I've had in a while was sitting in to taste with Ian D'Agata during one of his certification courses for the Vinitaly International Academy. Ian is an incredible person, and his knowledge of Italian wine is really phenomenal. He has a vast understanding of the specifics of Italian wine, and he possesses one of the most impressive intellects I have met in the wine world so far. Ian helps lead the Vinitaly International Academy, which is an educational organization designed to teach future generations of teachers for Italian wine. The Vinitaly International Academy offers courses, tastings, and testing designed to prepare Italian wine experts to go out into the world with a high level of knowledge and do some teaching for themselves. I have to tell you, this is a well thought out, well done, and extensive program, and if you are seriously interested in following up your knowledge of Italian wine, there is no better opportunity out there in the world than this one. The Vinitaly International Academy is a means to better mastery of Italian wine. It is something I highly recommend participating in. And if you would like to learn more and enroll in a future certification course from the Academy, contact Via at vinitalytour.com. That's V-I-A at vinitalytour.com. If you want to really know about Italian wine, this is the best email you'll ever send. Also, the Vinitaly International Academy will be taking CVs at the Astor Center in New York on the 21st through the 23rd of June 2016 and at McCormick Place in Chicago on the 28th of June. I'll drink to that, where we get into wine one person at a time. I'm your host, Levy Dalton. The show warm-ups are provided by Aaron Scala, and together we go behind the scenes of the beverage business.
This is Troy Bowen, wine buyer at Mondo Vino, Denver, Colorado.
Colleen Holden, wine director of Eastern Standard Kitchen and Drinks in Boston, Mass.
Steve Morgan, wine director from Formentos in Chicago.
Travis Henkel, beverage director of Treadsack Restaurants in Houston, Texas.
What do all of these buyers have in common? They know that 750 is a one-stop resource for the beverage alcohol trade. Search through local distributor portfolios, see upcoming trade tastings, and easily connect with your sales rep. It's free. And it's easy to sign up. Go to 750.com for more information. Angelo Guy on the show. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm fine.
So your dad stopped buying grapes in 1961.
Yes.
And that's also when you started at the winery. What was that period of time like for you?
Well, I was a beginner because I just left the school. I was 21 years old at that time. I joined the winery and my father asked me, instead of working the cellar, he told me, why not, for me it could be a good experience to spend the time in the vineyards. And I worked for almost 7 years in vineyards. And I believe that this was a very useful time for me, very profitable, because I introduced my feet in nature. And there was at the time a man, the name was Gino Cavallo, that was the responsible of vineyards. And he started trying to teach me. In the same time, I went even to school, to university for 4 years. And but I had the time to practice viticulture. And the school of this Gino, this man that was charged having taken care of our vineyards was precious for me. And I learned. I learned some steps that could seem not useful for me, because I never would have had to do this kind of work, working manually in the vineyards and so on. But I started understanding more about the time that work needed to be done. For us, that we are artisans, craft people, is important even to understand the kind of work that our people is doing in the vineyard and how the work can be done in a right way. We don't work with cooperatives workers that are many wineries are used to do and that they can do perfectly and so on. But we prefer to have our own people and train these people in a way, having them doing the work in our way. I don't say that is the better way, but it's our way, you know? And being artisan, this is important. So the school that I had at that time was very useful for me to understand the way of doing and so on. And Gino, the man that was charged to teach me, he had even a sense of humor beside the rigor. And sometime for him, I was not good enough, and he was asking me to spend more energy, more time, more dedication, that this was indispensable to know the work that he was used doing and so on. So this was a good school for me, and there are three factors in making the quality of a wine: the soil, the grape variety, and the weather. Well, during the life of a vineyard, the grape variety stays always the same. If the vineyard is planted Cabernet Sauvignon or Chardonnay or Nebbiolo, will always stay the same. The terroir, the land, if the land is a good terroir, is ready, capable in producing excellent grapes and excellent wine, during the life of the vineyard, the land is always the same, the soil is always the same. The big variation is in climate, because with excellent weather conditions, it's possible to make beautiful grapes and excellent wine. With very bad weather conditions, or hail, or a lot of rain during harvest season and so on, can be a disaster, and the quality is not there. So because I started really realizing the importance of weather, and that weather belongs to nature, and there is nothing to do. We can try to work in our in the best way that is possible for a grape grower, and after to be submitted to the variation of weather. Till the mid-90s, weather in our region was quite often during harvest time, a lot of rain, and the rain were damaging less or more the grapes. So quality was unpredictable. Not easy. I remember that normally in the 60s decade, in the 70s decade, in 80 decade, the bad vintages were 3, 4 out of 10. Today, after that, we are living in a time that probably there is a variation in weather. Today, that I don't know if I can talk about the climate change, but something is modifying in the weather in the vineyard, and the consequences are different. So today, that we have much more dry and hot summertime, and during autumn, it's not raining like it was used in the past. There is a much more opportunity of producing grapes of a certain level of quality and the consistency and repeating the quality. So this is a good aspect of what is happening now with climate change. There is even a less good aspect, and it means that parasites are becoming more aggressive. The growing season starts earlier, the harvest time starts earlier, and quite often there is an increase of sugar in the grapes and an increase of alcohol. And this is another aspect that because we don't like manipulate wine, and how to avoid, how to limit the increase of alcohol in the wine. We have to work more in the vineyards and to know more and so on, and I believe that we will be able to reduce and to have more control in our grapes. The greatest vintage was for me the first, and I was a beginner, was 61. Absolutely, in one was considered one of the greatest villages. 62 was good, the same, was not the same, was very good. But because the 61 was so great, and the consumers didn't take care of 62, that was an excellent vintage. 63 was difficult, not easy vintage. 64, again, very good vintage with a large crop. 61 had a very, very short crop, and the quality had a fantastic concentration, beautiful wine and so on. 64, the crop was much higher, the quality excellent, not at the same level of 61, but very good. And after, we had two vintages in a row, 65 and 66, very difficult. The quality was not there, less than average vintage. And 67 again, a good one, not great, but a good wine. And after another two difficult vintages, 68 and 69. And finally reaching 70, that was another very good vintage, and 71, a greatest one.
So did that difference between 61 and 64 partially convince you that you needed to reduce yields because it was the bigger crop?
This was already the concept of reducing or taking care of yields was already a concept of my father, not me. I wasn't prepared. I had no experience. I was lucky because I had him like a teacher, and for me it was very, very, very important experience. Despite my father was not used to tell me or to teach me, not because he was jealous at all, but because he thought that I had to know things. For him, it was so normal, you know, the way he was thinking, that he couldn't understand that I could think in a different way. So for him, so I had, in effect, to stole the knowledges from him. It's quite different what I do now with my children, because I have two daughters and a boy that are in the winery working with us, with me. So we are actually five, even my wife. We have no other activity. The only work that we do full time is our work in terms of wine producers and selling the wine in the market and producing grapes and so on. So taking care of this and so on, but full time. So now I try to transfer to my children as much as possible. And I try to talk as much as possible to them. And I believe that it's important in a way to help them to recuperate the kind of culture or experiences that I had in my life. My father didn't do it in this way. But I repeat, because it was a different attitude. So, and I had for me, in effect, working not full time, because for almost 4 years I went to university and so on, but I had quite good time to learn there in the vineyards. And this is only 7 years after that I had the chance of entering the cellar. So about your question, about the crop, the yield, my father was first at that time in Piedmont to understand that it was important for producing quality grapes and the quality wines. It was important to afford sacrifices. What kind of sacrifices? First of all, to take care, to take control of quantity, of yield. So asking time to time to his workers to do all the steps in a way to take control of a quantity, of yield. So reducing the quantity. At that time, this was an attitude unthinkable, difficult to understand for workers, because the crop, the natural crop, was given by nature, by God. Why to reduce? Why to take control? That everybody needed, you know, adding mind the quantity and so on. So I remember that my father was not easy to ask Gino, the responsible of vineyards, to be careful, starting, planting a vineyard, trying to use rootstock or Nebbiolo variety more adaptable to have low vigor and the producing less. If perhaps after the flowering time, the production was too big, starting to do and to reduce the number of benches, but this was very, very difficult to have people at the time understanding, because the concept and the idea that the quality was made by a crop not too big, not too high, and so on, was at the time rare, not understood like today. And even another kind of sacrifice that he did many times, in occasion of bad vintages, because bad weather during the growing season, it was available not to bottle the wine and selling the wine entirely in bulk. What did it mean at the time? Losing 80% of your money, you know, was a big loss. But he was very severe with himself and had a lot of rigor. And doing that, I believe that he gave the chance to Gaia consumers, the consumers of our wine, to find in the market always high quality wines, because he refused to bottle the low quality. So often the consumers don't know about the weather conditions. They don't know about, you know, the quality of... that, doing the sacrifice that he did and refusing to bottle wines, sometime 2, 3, 4 vintages out of 10, this became for him in long term a big advantage comparing other wine producers.
And your grandmother was quite important in your life early on.
Well, I believe that is important for me, but not only for me, for a lot of people, is important to, you need to have teachers, you know? And if the condition is continuing doing the family business, you have to have someone teaching you. And I was lucky because in the family, my two big teachers were grandmother and my father. Grandmother was born in 1880, and when I joined the winery in 61 is the year that she died. But I was 21 years old. So I had the time to learn by her when I was younger, and till 21 years old. And I believe that her lessons were quite important. The first very important one is when I was 11 years old and I was with her in Barbaresco, because I grew up in Alba, that is a town, is the main town of Lange district, and is a town far 7 miles from Barbaresco. And I had the chance in the month, I remember, of August, at the end of August, before starting school in September, to spend some time with the grandmother. And I was doing my homework, you know, to do the work that the students are used to doing during vacation and so on. And she had to take a control, to have a look to my homework. So I was seated, and she was back me, and she asked me, what do you like to do in your life? I was 11 years old. I had no idea at all what to do, how to give her an answer. And I didn't give an answer. And she repeated, I stay silent. And finally she said to me, look, in your life, you have to become an artisan. And to become an artisan, there are 4 steps. And you have to follow these 4 steps. The 4 steps are fare, saper fare, saper far fare, far sapere. She told me even in France, because she studied in Chambéry, the capital of Savoie, and she became school teacher, and she learned very well France, and she said me even, repeated even to me in France, faire, savoir faire, savoir faire, faire. I had no idea this word. And she explained me. Fare means to do. Everybody in life have to do something, to make money, to eat, to spend time, to have an occupation, to do some time with passion, some other time no passion. But the saper fare, to reach the know-how, to have the know-how. So this is a specific of artisan. Artisan is someone in different fields, in all kind of work, activity, and so on. Is a guy that has a project. And he has a project in his mind, and is his own project. And he likes to make the project in his way. Sometime can be successful, some other time not, because is principally for him. And taking care of his project, spending time to know, to understand all details in a way to improve the quality of his project and so on. And with the passion and dedicating and so on, maybe that sometime it happens that he can be successful in his work. And at that time, in Italy, we say that after time, he will become a maestro. And this is the third step, saper far fare, to teach how. So it means to teach how, to reach the know-how to his collaborators, to his children, to his family, and so on. And finally, it's not finished. It's important the far sapere, to transmit the knowledge in a way that the consumers, the people that has a benefit of the work of artisan, can understand the work and the communication, marketing, call as you like. So I was 11 years old. Grandmother told me that. I had no idea. I couldn't understand. I had no idea. I remember that she wrote me on a piece of paper that I lost, unfortunately. But after my grandmother repeated me many times, and my father repeated to me. So my teachers, my grandmother and my father, my grandmother, I remember always about this concept. To become an artisan, you have to take care of far sapere. And so grandmother, principally, I believe that really, for me, was a great teacher, a woman with rigor, smiling rarely, was a special woman. I was intimidated by her. She was a great teacher for me. And after I had my father, that was my that I lived with, because my father died in 2002 and was active in the winery till 92, 93. So absolutely, despite I had to stole my knowledges by him, because he was not used telling and so on, but was a great, and he had so many ideas that still today are have a value. And even he was the first in 1937 introducing in a winery a label that was a new one with a new concept absolutely in my region, with the brand Gaia, with our family name written 3 centimeters, written big on the top of the label. This was absolutely new. It was a concept I never seen before. And it was the beginning of a new concept. And why he did that? Because he thought absolutely true that who drinks wine, the consumer, has to know who's the guy back that produces wine. So the brand name became a guarantee of a quality, became a guarantee of a method, of a philosophy, of a way of making wine. So quite important. And he was in my region, the first to start this concept in 1937, when at the time it was in Piedmont, totally, totally unknown. At the time, the wineries were in the hand of negotiants, of bigger producers that didn't own vineyards, just buying grapes, making wine and selling wine. My father was one of the first in the area to produce wines exclusively by his own grape. So for him, the project started already in the vineyards and taking care of the crop, of yield, and so on, working in a way to be guaranteed to have the guarantee of producing quality grapes and after selling the wine.
To be a grower producer.
Yes, absolutely.
Was a new thing.
To be a state, you know, to be to have a control, having the control starting by vineyards.
There was an oenologist that your father had hired that retired in 1970.
Yes, because the name was Luigi Rama, was a man that produced wine for my father for a long time. And a talented man with a lot of experience. He was not really he didn't go to school, but he had to practice. He knew all about it. And his way of making wine was corresponding exactly the feeling and the idea of my father. So when I joined the winery, our family business in 61, and I told you that I spent 7 years in vineyards, is only in 60, at the end of 68, beginning 69, that I entered in the cellar to work with, beside my father, winemaker. And he was already 65 or 66 years old, and he liked his even to retire. So in a relatively short time, I looked for a young winemaker, the name Guido Rivella, that was a native from Barbaresco, and Guido Rivella joined the winery in March 70. And for the first 2-3 years, he worked beside the older one, Luigi Rama, and after he went on.
And he had gone to the same school of enology that you had.
Yes, exactly, because I went to school to Alba, like him, but he, in effect, was responsible of a Gaia cellar for 45 years, because he worked there for 45 years. And incredible, and very talented man, and I believe that I have to recognize that the quality of Gaia wines was largely due to his work. He did very well. And even he helped, he had an assistant, the name is Alessandro Albarello, that now is winemaker at Gaia Winery, because Guido Rivella retired 2 years ago, despite he's still time to time coming to the winery and overlooking, having an interest, and I'm very happy about that, but not it doesn't give me the full-time, is a full-time work after 45 years, of course, and now he has even for himself a small winery producing excellent wine and an agriturismo, you know. We grew up together, you know, and
it seemed like a little brother for you.
Yes, yes,
a little bit,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes, and so in effect, I went to the same school of him, but he was responsible of the cellar.
You kind of both started together in the cellar.
Yes, in 70. So we grew up together, and I believe that my work was absolutely in terms of being the owner of the company. So the responsibility was of Guido Rivella, and he knew all the different aspects in the winery. But with me, with my taste, and I tried to inspire even him, of course, to do in what, sorry, it was my way, you know, the way of the artisan, yes. And never we had a conflict. Sometime, of course, it could happen that, yes, like in a marriage, you know, but it was a perfect situation and collaboration. We worked very well. What was important for me even was because my father didn't know languages. So my father pushed me at the end of the 60s, beginning 70s, to go outside and to reach new markets and to reach new experiences, because traveling is the best way to learn. So I started traveling and having experiences and knowing and talking to people and so on. What a fantastic experience. I remember always in 74 when I met Robert Mondavi, you know, and talking to him, it was contagious, because he was doing a lot of experience in a way to increase the perception of Californian wines and making better quality wines and so on, and the steps that he did and so on. So I believe that at that time, in the 70s, when I started the traveling, and I had much more the perception, and my knowledge is increased, and this was an experience that my father never had, and for me was quite useful. And I knew new teachers, you know, or new people even that I could capture some experience and creating my knowledge and so on. But again, was my father that pushed me, and he said me, because honestly, at the time, Barbaresco and Barolo were two wines not so well understood in the market. And apparently it seemed that especially the market outside from Europe could be difficult to accept similar wines, because it belonged more to a culture that we had in Europe, the culture of terroir, of course, at that time, the culture of indigenous grape variety that could produce special wine, original wine, the idea that this originality has to be protected and maintained, absolutely, because is something that gives is a specialty for a wine that gives a special character. But beside that, if you have a wine that is different because of its originality and so on, and after it's important to teach people how to drink and how to use. So it seemed that not because we were underestimated U.S. people, that Now, it's not by chance that it's the most important market for premium wine in the world, the U.S. But at the time, it seemed to be difficult to introduce this kind of wines, even Brunello di Montalcino or Amarone and so on, Barbaresco, Barolo, outside from Europe. It seemed that our cradle, the area that could accept more our wines, was Europe. But my father forced me, and he told, look, you have to explore and so on. And this was another, was a step for me quite important, knowing at that time, in I remember that in 74 I was in Napa, and I visited Mondavi. Zelman Ong was a winemaker there, and for me it was a very good experience meeting her, and after she went to work at Simi Winery and so on. Well, in occasion of my first trip, I had the chance of visiting a winery in Sonoma, the name Hanzel, H-A-N-Z-E-L-L. I was surprised. At the time, the owner of Hanzel was von Zellerbach. He was a previous U.S. ambassador in Paris. And he loved so much the Burgundian wines that in project to retire, he liked to have a winery in Sonoma producing wines similar to Burgundy wines. So Pinot Noir, planting Pinot Noir and the Chardonnay, and producing wine with in a small winery with tiny equipment. And I was surprised about this concept, this idea. So in a time that in the United States, it was booming the interest for, especially for Cabernet Sauvignon. But this was a delicate wine and not easy and so on. And after I saw the process of American producers, smart, they learn. And they looked for area close to the sea. So they discovered Carneros for planting Pinot Noir. And after they went to Mendocino and close to the Pacific coast. And after they discovered Santa Rita, Santa Ines, and so on. But Hanzel for me was something that starting opening me the mind and having even curiosity for some international grape variety that never we had in my region. So the idea was first to plant even because the dream for many producers in producing premium red wines in some area is why not to have the chance even of producing a premium white wine. I started to cultivate in the early 70s, after 74, 75, the dream, the idea in producing a white wine in a small quantity, having in Lange. And I looked to looking to a grape variety that already in the world was able in producing through this variety great wines. Chardonnay did it. And we decided finally to plant a vineyard of Chardonnay in 1979. At that time, and even having a barrel aging.
Sure, for, which is what Hanzel did, right? Yes, they got in French wood.
Exactly. So. And we did, in some way we were successful. And this was an idea that my father hadn't, because even for him, he was, I don't say reluctant. He didn't, he was not against the idea of planting a Chardonnay vineyard. But for him, it seemed to be a loss of time, because for him, the wine had one only color. Red. So he couldn't understand why to plant a Chardonnay vineyard. And I remember that I told him that this could be because Lange, my district, has a beautiful land, and I am a believer in this land, and that could be possible, despite we had no experience before. But it was something that was not for him of special interest. For me, in effect, it was the result even to plant a Chardonnay of experiences that I had in a different part of the world, even in the United States. So this gave me. And we were lucky because the wine had success and so on, went on and so on. And even we planted the year before a small vineyard of Cabernet Sauvignon. This I had, it was more difficult to convince my father to give me the chance of doing this step. Despite my father never, we never fighted. I never had problems with my father, despite we could think in a different way. But he was very tolerant, and he taught me tolerance. Very important. Even running a company, having your collaborators and so on, being respectful and being able to contrast with arguments, you know, with and to convince if people doesn't think like me in my company, I have to be able to convince them with ideas and so on. If not, I have to accept, you know, or to modify my ideas and so on. So my father, having respect of this concept of tolerance, and despite he didn't like the idea of planting a red grape variety such as Cabernet Sauvignon, never planted before in the past in Piedmont, in the last century, not in the past, never planted before. And so he tried to give me advices. Look, we have already, he was right, we have already, Nebbiolo is our king red variety, planted in Piedmont for 800 years. Why you need to plant a Cabernet Sauvignon, that we have already a king red variety? But finally, because he was insisting, at the end, he gave me the permit. So this is very important step. So he gave me the chance of having a project for myself. So for children that are entering and doing work in a family business, especially in artisanal family business, the parents that are still in the company have to understand that you cannot oblige children to follow and to do my project. You have to leave them to give their own project. And, you know, and to have to be, to try to give them good advices. If you believe that it's not good, to try to tell all the reasons why it's not good. But if they, at the end they like to have this and to go on with the project, this is their project, you cannot contrast it till at the end, you have to leave it, you know. So my father understood that this was a good lesson that I have for my children too. So to understand that creating a continuity, going on by generation, is quite important to give children the chance of cultivating, of having their own project. So we planted the Cabernet Sauvignon and so on.
So it sounds to me like you saw that Robert Mondavi planted Cabernet in Napa, and that people started to, at that time, then to start to talk about Napa as a great wine region in
yes.
the world.
Yes.
And then Hanzel planted Chardonnay
yes.
in Sonoma, and
yes.
people started to talk yes. about Sonoma as a
yes.
great wine region.
Yes.
And they weren't talking about Piemonte in the world,
yes.
but you thought it was a good wine region. So you thought, if I plant Chardonnay and Cabernet, maybe people will talk about this region as a great region in the world.
Yes, exactly. Because Chardonnay and Cabernet Sauvignon are more known in the market than wines made by Nebbiolo grapes, but Cabernet and Chardonnay are planted everywhere. So what does it mean that? It means that consumers have more the knowledge of the taste and are more acceptable, more ready to accept a taste of Cabernet Chardonnay made in another area that they can recognize, more difficult to understand the taste of an indigenous grape variety never heard before, you know. So the idea of planting a small quantity, having a small vineyard surface of international grape variety could be a marketing strategy, you know, in a way to be accepted if the wines made in my area, in my winery, produced by Chardonnay and Cabernet Sauvignon, could be original, could be something special in terms of quality. This could be a good message in a way to reach the attention of international consumers and after introducing to them Barbaresco and Barolo easier, you know. This could be an idea. And my father he didn't like the idea of Cabernet Sauvignon. And for what concern the Chardonnay, for him, white wine was nothing, you know. So he told me, do you like to plant? Okay, do. For Cabernet Sauvignon, a little bit of more resistant, but never fighting together.
And at the same time, when you made those new bottlings, you named one, partly it's named after one of your daughters, another white wine is named after your other daughter.
Well, about the names, we never gave geographical name to our, why? because some geographical way can mean nothing special for me. No, Barbaresco and Barolo, of course, are very special in the appellation. But names of smaller region in the area, for me was more important to give names to our wines that can have a relation with some sentimental aspect, some history, something belonging, you know, the way that we were there. So we dedicated the names, for example, to my grandmother, Sori Tilding. Tilding was the nickname of my grandmother, Clotilde Rey, and Clotilde, Tilde, Tilding. So the wine was in some way dedicated to her, and other names that belonged to our history and our way to be in being there. For me, was more important that a geographical name, smaller, that couldn't be less important.
So what about Spers? What was that purchase like for you in Sierra Leone?
Spers was the last buy that important buy that we did in Sierra Leone in 1988. This Spers is a special meeting, and for me is absolutely was the first step outside a Barbaresco area. So I born in Alba. At the time, my winery, like today, is based in Barbaresco. But at the time, we owned exclusively land for producing Barbaresco wine. Well, I tell you the story of Spers. My father, when he was 17, 18, 19 years old, because he went to school in Torino, far from Barbaresco, 35 miles, and he studied there. And when he was there, going to school at the third, fourth, fifth year, my grandmother, his mother, went to his professor in Torino, asking him to have the chance of having Giovanni, her son, at home during the month of October. It was school time. And initially, the professor was reluctant, telling to my grandmother, but you know, losing 1 month is too much and so on. But after he realized that my father was a very good student and that even losing a month could recuperate after, so at the end told that, okay, gave the permit. So my father, for 3 years, when he was 17, 18, 19 years old, spent 1 month of October in Piedmont harvesting grapes. And the harvest was, for the first 10 days, he was used to spending the time in Barbaresco with the care of his mother, my grandmother, Clotilde Rey. Clotilde Rey was very severe, and she was used asking my father to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. Despite it was still dark, and there was no needing of getting up so early and so on, but this was like military. So get up at 6 o'clock, and after to go to work at 8, harvesting and harvesting all the day and having a small lunch, and only at 6 or 7 o'clock to have a dinner. And the dinner was for all the workers there all together. And during they were used at the time even to invite harvesters, you know, other people to harvest and so on. Normally were young people, and often were young girls. And this was an occasion, you know, to familiarize, to know girls, and to for male, and to talk together and so on. So they were used after dinner to spend some time talking together, the people and the girls, and the laughing and talking and so on, normal like it does everywhere in the world. But my grandmother asked Giovanni, her son, to go to bed at 9 o'clock. So this, despite, was the time eventually to spend with, he couldn't. The rule was for grandmother, go to bed. So, and he was used to having a room that had the windows on the square below, where he could hear the girls and the other talking and laughing and so on till at 11 o'clock, sometime midnight, but he had to stay in bed. And even no tip. So it was very severe, this, and the grandmother was very strict, rigorous. But after these 10 or 12 days, he had the permit to go in another area in Barolo district, in a small village called Serralunga to harvest grapes there in a family that were very good friend of my grandmother. And normally was used spending there 15 days of October. But there was a paradise because he could get up when he liked. He was treated like a prince. He had some tip. And after dinner, he could spend the time as he liked, and even in the square, talking and laughing with girls and so on till midnight, 1 o'clock. So this was a paradise. And he started thinking that this was a fantastic vineyard, a beautiful place. And he started dreaming, how can I, if I have to go outside and to buy a vineyard outside from Barbaresco district, I would like to buy this vineyard. And he had always in mind this vineyard. And this is a great piece of land that belonged to people that had this land for a long time. You know, the great terroir are not in sale, rarely are in sale. And when the great were arrive in sale, if you like to buy, you have to be ready at the time and buy it. If not, you lose the occasion and you will have to wait 50 or 60 years before. So it happened that my father looked carefully to buy this land. And in his approach, it was for my father, he was thinking that if he had to buy a piece of land outside the Barbaresco area, in Barolo area, had to be this. This is impossible, you know, to cultivate this idea. Was. In fact, by the time, he had many offers to buy a piece of land in Barolo district, not that one, not this one. And always he refused, because for him, only this piece had to be. So he was unsuccessful. I was at Vinitaly a Sunday afternoon. We had a booth, a wall full of people. I was tired, full of people, a confusion. And this was April 88. And I had a friend of mine, a broker, that joined me in the booth, my booth at Vinitaly in 88. And he told me, there is a piece of land in sale in Barolo district. And I told him, look, I have no time. I have so many, and I will be back. This was a Sunday. I will be back on Wednesday when the fair will be finished, and I will call you and so on. Okay. But before leaving, I asked him, but sorry, where, in which village? And he told me, the land to sell is in Serralunga. In Serralunga? Where? And he told me exactly the vineyard that my father had the dream of buying and for all his life. My God, was like electricity. And I told him, look, just a minute. If it's for this piece of land, I can come back tomorrow, Monday, and I would like to have the chance of meeting these people and to be prepared to them eventually to sell. And I came back on Monday, and the Monday late evening, I met the owners and they signed the deal. And I bought the property without visiting the property. I didn't go to visit the property. I bought on the paper. And we called this piece of land to make the wine that my father was dreaming and so on. And we call the wine Spers, S-P-E-R-S-S. It's a Piedmontese dialect word that means nostalgia. What? Nostalgia, this nostalgia that my father had for years because he dreamed to have the chance of buying this piece of land where he was used harvesting the grapes when he was 17, 18 years old. And after, finally, I could buy this piece of land, and we called the wine Spers nostalgia because in memory of him. He was very happy because he was alive at the time, when in 88, and he was enthusiastic and so on. So for me, the name, the geographical name of the area is Marenca e Rivette. But for me, Marenka Rivet, Spers had much more meaning, you know, because back there is an history, there is a feelings, there is a dream that belonged to my father and myself too.
You also started an import business, and yes. I imagine that you met some key figures in the international wine community during that time. You imported DRC, you imported Vega Sicilia to Italy.
Yes, well, this was a little bit unusual for an Italian wine producer. In effect, I had the chance of becoming importer of DRC wines in 1977. I was absolutely not known at the time in the U.S. market. And I was a little bit embarrassed coming to the United States, and because sometimes wine writers were knowing that I was through a company called the Gaia Distribution, that we were the importers of the DRC, I became more important for being recognized as importer of the DRC wine than for Gaia, you know? But a little bit embarrassing because I was having reflect an image that, in effect, didn't belong to me. But, okay, yes, it's true. We started opening a company for importing and distributing wines from different countries, even from the United States and so on. We became importer of Mondavi. And it was another chance of learning because when a wine producer like me, but at the time that I was introduced in a winery that we started importing the wine. So I entered there like an importer, not like a wine producer. And the winery was more available to open me and to tell me about their strategy, you know. Sometime maybe that for a colleague that can be seen like a competitor, probably they are a little bit more. But for someone that is entering and asking and so on, like an importer is different. And this was another good opportunity for me to learn a little bit in a different area, different countries, different wine producers and so on. This was good.
So let me ask you, you have both holdings in Barbaresco and in Trezzo, but none in Neve, right?
We have a property in Barbaresco, Trezzo, and Alba, no in Neve.
What are the differences between growing in Trezzo? Is it higher elevation?
In Trezzo, we own a vineyard in an area that is called the Paioré, that is not the highest one in the highest area of Trezzo, that Barbaresco is at 270 meters sea level, and the Trezzo is 450. But the Paioré is at 350, a little bit lower. And the more we have a piece of land there at close 400, 420 meters, that we planted Gaia Ray, the Chardonnay. So in the past, Trezzo was considered for the higher land till 500 meters, not proper for planting Nebbiolo grapes. Today, probably or in future, it will be possible. But to give an answer to your question, so, okay, we have a vineyard in Trezzo, partially in Nebbiolo and Chardonnay, and in Barbaresco Furs and in Alba.
You have Paioré, right?
Yeah, we have Paioré, yes, exactly.
That's the old Moresco. That's the Cedar Moresco.
Yes, this belonged to a family that the name was Giovannini Moresco, that was used already producing wines from there and so on. And after I bought there the property in 79, I bought first 50% and I ran his rest 50%. And after 7 years, he sold me even the other 50%. And today we are the total owner of the property of Giovannini Moresco.
And you made the wine for two vintages.
And I made for him the wine, yes, in 78 and 79. Yes, right.
And what was... What was he like? As a person, what was he like?
I believe that the wine produced by him had a very good image, and even he was a good promoter of his wine because he liked very much, he was a gourmet. He liked the good food, and he was used to going in having... very good friend in some excellent restaurants where he was used to giving his wine, and his wine was appreciated and so on, so we went on quite well. But after, he decided to sell, and I could buy, and I bought, yes.
May I ask you about some of the other sort of key and historical figures of the Barbaresco zone over the years that you may have known? Because I've never met. So Giacosa in person.
Yes.
What's he like?
I believe that he's one of the best wine producers that is in the area. He's a great guy. He started working that he was 16 years old in 1946. And he started working with his father that was a grape broker. And he learned to become a grape broker, selling grapes of other producers, for almost 14 years, till 1960, that finally decided to open his own winery. But by the time, he became the best grape taster in the area. His father was already a broker. And to be a broker, apparently, what was more important was to be able to convince who sells something to find a deal with who buys, you know? And so it's more important to be a good talker, you know, than a taster. But he was absolutely, he became a great grape taster, one of the few, absolutely. And he was able probably at that time because he had the chance of visiting different vineyards of different proprietors. And not only to find the buyer and just to find the way of doing a deal, but even for him it was important to know about the quality of grapes. And he became, I repeat, a grape taster and so on. And I believe that for the first in the decade, 60s, 70s and 80s, he took a lot of benefit in having this activity, because he was able even to keep for him probably the best grapes available, because he was smart, he was able for the grapes that he was used to buying to pay the higher price, and was very smart, very, very correct, doing well. And it took a lot of benefit of his experience of a grape taster in making wine as negotiant for a long time. But this was the time that the large majority of grapes were arriving on the market, almost 90% or 80% of grapes. Today, a lot of people that was used to selling grapes to him became a wine producer, you know? So there is no more chance for a negotiant to do the same work that he did at that time. And in effect, he started buying land 20 years ago, 15 years ago, and making wine. But he's not in a perfect health today. Bruno Giacosa is one of the monuments of the area, and he has a daughter that is quite talented, and that today is able to run the winery quite good.
And Armando Cordero, when he was making Barbaresco for Franco Fiorina, did you see him buying grapes?
Yes, this Franco Fiorina was another negotiant. Franco Fiorina never owned the land, vineyards, but he through this Franco Cordero, a winemaker of excellent capability, knowledge, taste. Cordero worked there for a long time at Franco Fiorina till Franco Fiorina sold the winery, and he was a good selector of a grape variety. But in effect, he had not the same knowledge. Desparti was a great connoisseur, but Giacosa that was used to being a broker before, you know, than a winemaker, being a broker. So collected even, but you picked the name of a very important man, Cordero, that was able even, was he entered in the commission of the Barbaresco and Barolo appellation for judging the wines to be bottled, to give the bottled, to the permit to producers to bottle the wine if the quality was reaching the status. Great guy there to be recognized.
And you were friends with Giacomo Bologna before he died.
Yes, Giacomo Bologna was the man that put the Barbera on the stage, and absolutely. And Giacomo Bologna had an incredible sensibility. He was able even to reach the confidence of the people, poor people, simple people, and very rich, and putting together on the table, and socializing all together, and making the wine the connection of for these people. Because, you know, wine is the most, is the beverage that has the larger culture. Is cultural beverage, and the wine is able to reflect, is the ambassador of the character of an area. So when you taste a wine, you can recognize, if you are a good taster, you can recognize not only the grape variety, but even the kind of climate that are there. And sometimes through the wine, you can even understand the kind of people that makes the wine and the story of an area, the tradition, or if of the area is new. The wine is an incredible ambassador of all these events. So Bologna was able, through wine, to socialize the people and to create for people that were attending to his friendship or to his way of being in the market or creating events and so on, people became crazy of him. Was absolutely unique guy. Unique, absolutely.
And you knew
he died in 1990, and there was a big loss for the world of wine there, especially for Barbera, because Barbera sometimes was misunderstood in terms of the quality, not always at the level, sometimes arriving in the market, low-level quality wines and so on, so some conflict. But he was able to raise up the flag of Barbera and to help people to recognize the quality there.
And you knew Romano Levi well.
Romano Levi was a grappa producer, and he was used to making grappa with an alambic of first generation, so direct fire. It means that the pomaces were introduced in the alambic and the fire was direct. So needs a lot of experience because the direct, non a bagnomaria, not through water, but a direct fire. So the grappa producer has to have a lot of experience in not to burn the. But I cannot say that his grappa was phenomenal in terms of quality, but he was phenomenal. Because he was using labels that he was used writing by hand. All his labels were written by hand. So you understand immediately that the production had to be small, could not be a larger production. And what was special that he was able to report to write on a label some aspect, a step of his life. And this was unique, this. And he started to attract visitors in Neive. And there was always a queue of people on a Saturday and Sunday waiting to have the chance of talking to him. And perhaps to buy some bottles, because were rare, not easy to have to buy bottles for everybody. Unique. He was able to give value to grappa. Grappa was considered, no wood aged, and for poor people, popular beverage and so on. And he was able to give a value, to understand, to help people understanding that was a spirit, but was the spirit of the place, something special. And through him, because he was designing the label, the bottles were special, absolutely.
And the last person, your dad, what was he like as a person? What was he like, your dad?
My father was reserved, was not a man that you can enter in contact immediately very easy, but very loyal. He spent the time, he was mayor of Barbaresco, major of Barbaresco for 25 years, available to work even for other people, for the community, and he had the vision. His way of being an artisan was very appreciated in the area. I never heard a word of my father against one of his colleagues. Never. Even when colleagues were selling the wine Barbaresco at a very low price, that someone could think they are destroying or not damaging the image and so on. Never. Only being able to talk well about the colleagues that for him were producing quality wines, but not a word against of his. I like it this way of being respectful of the work and the idea that can be different from you, of other people in making wine, because there are different kind of consumers. The attitude of wineries to satisfy, they are different, because for the occasional consumer, It's important to have a wine sometime. They would like to spend a little bit of money just to have wine. Some other would like to have a bottle that they can that can satisfy, easy to understand. And was the habit is different, the connoisseur is different, the expert is different. So we have to understand that there are the winery are working for different selection, a kind of people. So my father was considering respecting the wineries producing wines at low price, because there is a request of these wines. Why you have to contrast and so on. And after he could give a judge and to this wine, but he was not aggressive, you know, and he could consider. And again, for other people that was producing only the best, okay, it was available to taste and so on. But this attitude of being tolerant, being respectful of the work of other people that is working different from you in the was chapeau.
Angelo Gallo remembers his father quite well, and he's provided for his own family the future and also done well for Primonte. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Angelo Gallo of the Gallo Winery in Piemonte, Ca' Marcanda, and Pieve Santa Restituta in Tuscany. Before we finish up this episode, we have some people to thank. A big thank you to the amazing Alder Yarrow and his website, vinography.com, where you can find write-ups and warm-ups for the show, as well as other exceptional content. A huge thank you also to Drew Hendricks and James Tidwell of TechSom, who made a generous and really game-changing donation of new equipment to this show. You can check out TechSom.com, that's TechSom.com, to see what they're up to in their own endeavor. It's always a pleasure also to be involved with Crush Wine and Spirits in Manhattan, with whom we have a wine club for regularly discounted offers on wines that we feature on this show. You can write to me directly at levyopenswine@gmail.com to find out how you can join in on our wine club. And also our thanks to you, the audience. Together, we get to really sit down and learn about wine one person at a time. You can let us know what you think on our Facebook page or by following us on Twitter at DrinkToThatPod. You can also check out pictures on Instagram at levyopenswine, that's me, or you can leave a comment and a review in iTunes. We love iTunes comments. They go a long way to help us out, too. Also, if you haven't subscribed to the show yet on iTunes, you should go ahead and hit that up. iTunes subscribers see new episodes in their feed before non-subscribers, and often new episodes arrive several hours or even days earlier for subscribers. If you want to listen to the newest episode of the show, and also if you want to listen to back episodes from when we first got started, the easiest way to do so is to subscribe in iTunes. Our website is alldrinktothatpod.com. That's alldrinktothatpod.com with no apostrophe in the ill. And you can find information there about buying a t-shirt to wear around so you can show your support, or also about how to donate to the show. There's some back episode listings on the website as well. We'll see you again next episode, and cheers.